Hey, what's going on, everybody? From the College of Professional and Continuing Education at Cal State Long Beach, I'm Dr. Pahul Sukhasikhan with Pacing Your Future, a podcast that charts the course of today's most exciting industries and the people that help shape them. Discover the many opportunities within the numerous fields we cover and be inspired by the stories of notable individuals who have paved their own paths. And just like our name suggests, our mission is to pace ahead, be proactive, adaptable, creative, and engaged. Whether you're seeking career insights, industry trends, or just simply inquisitive, let's pace your future together. And today we are joined by Tom Moen. Tom is the Chief External Affairs Officer and former CEO of One Legacy, the largest organ recovery agency in the U.S. Since 2000, he has led One Legacy to significant achievements, including doubling organ donation and tripling tissue donation. Under his leadership, One Legacy implemented numerous innovations, such as electronic donor records, real-time nucleic acid testing, and the Donate Life California DMV linked registry. Tom also spearheaded the creation of the Donate Life Rose Parade float, which has become a major public promotion of organ donation. Welcome to the show, Tom.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you, Paul.
Of course. So we usually want to start with a fun and easy question before we dig into the brutal interview. So let's start off with fun. Imagine your industry is the main character in a blockbuster movie because Los Angeles, and why not? What's the plot and who are its main characters?
Wow. I actually don't have to imagine that because our work is a subject of so many TV shows, movies, some blockbusters. John Q was one, and Seven Ounces or whatever that was. A whole series of movies and TV shows that have featured organ donation and transplantation and usually botched it up really horribly. It is an easy subject to, it's sort of like clickbait. You can just take your shot and use any myth that's out there. My favorite one is, you know, the kid who wakes up in the bathtub of ice in Las Vegas because somebody took his kidney overnight and they're going to transplant it in their garage or whatever they're going to do with it. You know, completely made up. Or the kidney or liver that's kidnapped from the back of an ambulance as it's on its way from a donor hospital to a recipient transplant center. These things that have never happened, but you know. But our reality is in our space. You thought this was a fun question. In our space, this is actually real. And there's a researcher, Susan Morgan at Purdue, who did research and found that these shows actually cause people to choose not to register as donors, not check the box of the DMV, take their registrations off, families to say no to donation if their loved one passes away. So it has a real impact on life. So we started a program called Donate Life Hollywood. Today we call it One Legacy Inspires Hollywood. And it really has inspired because since we started that program and got in front of writers, producers, and directors, we've actually changed the narrative so much so that a few years ago we sort of shelved the program. But then streaming came and a whole bunch of new writers, producers, and directors making new stuff up every day. So we reinvigorated it. And it's been actually great to get in front of them because there's actually nothing more dramatic and a better line than the real story of a family who's chosen to make something good come from their loss, and the human drama of a family finding gratitude in that is pretty powerful. And I'll just finish one of the best things we ever did is producers that they include what we call an honor walk, when a donor is donating their organs is wheeled in the gurney from the ICU where they've been treated and managed for 2 or 3 days to the OR where their organs are going to be recovered by the transplant surgeons who will then go that day and transplant them and save lives. And the hospital staff and the family and friends and our own staff stand along there in honor of that gift. The most moving thing you'll ever see on a show or a movie, and it turned out to be the better storyline and help save lives rather than prevent that.
I mean, like, as you know, I can empathize in terms of, you know, the way in which Hollywood has portrayed certain things, so just because I'm ethnically Thai. And so the way Thailand has been portrayed in like contemporary media, right, and in the past, and has kind of like filled it with colorful things and colorful nuances, right?
Yeah, good and bad.
Good and bad, right? Yeah. I mean, think about
better than it could ever be, and hopefully worse than it could ever be. I mean, it's the nature of entertainment,
of course.
And what we recognize is you got to embrace it. We are in Hollywood, and The woman who started our program, her husband was an editor, her father was a filmmaker, her mother was a studio instructor for kid actors. So she said, I can do Hollywood. You know, they're going to do this, but we can help them do it right. And yeah, it turns out to be, it's a good way to think about how you help people see the world differently and make something better come from it.
Definitely. So I think this is a good segue in terms of like just introducing the folks about One Legacy. Just could you tell us what One Legacy is and how does its role as the nation's largest organ procurement organization impact organ donation and transplantation landscape in Southern California?
Sure. So One Legacy has really been serving Southern California since 1968, when transplantation really just began. That time, actually, only two organ recovery programs officially in the country, but there are a whole bunch assigned to transplant centers. Well, as a field, we've matured, and today there are 55 scattered around the country. One Legacy is the largest. We're designated by the federal government as the agency that works with all hospitals in the Southern California area, all 215 hospitals north of San Diego. We have colleagues in San Diego, but all the way up to Kern County and Santa Barbara. And we serve 20 million people here, and we will get referral calls from hospitals, 13,000 a year of possible donors. And these are people who have suffered a major neurologic injury, which they may not recover, and we'll evaluate that. Some rule out immediately. There may be 85 or have active cancer, and they don't have viable organs to transplant. But we'll go on site on 10,000 or more of those calls. Immediately, within an hour of getting the call, we'll have somebody dispatched to go on site and evaluate that potential donor. And the best day is when their evaluation finds out that the donor is actually recovering and going to go home. But that doesn't always happen. And when it can't happen, we work with the hospital and the staff, and when it's clear that the individual has been declared brain dead or the family and the doctors have recognized that they cannot recover and they're going to turn off a ventilator, then we'll work with the family to make donation opportunity to make something good come from that. And we do that 24/7, 365. We also do that with bone and skin and corneas. And we get like 80,000 calls for those types of cases as well. So it's a lot of work going on all the time.
Definitely. And I mean, like you mentioned huge numbers, right? In terms of the people and the communities you service. I mean, 2 million individuals, right? I think that leads into our next question of what initiatives and innovative strategies does One Legacy undertake to raise public awareness and encourage organ donation within the community? And I think this question also speaks to, like, you know, what we were initially talking about, like the ways in which Hollywood or contemporary popular culture may skew what organ donation is, right? Or how it's done.
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the things. Obviously, our One Legacy Inspires Hollywood program is a piece of that public education, because if you can get your story told right on a major TV show or a movie, you've got a huge audience. And we learned very quickly, you go to where there's already an audience. The other big thing we do is we have a float in the Tournament of Roses parade every New Year's Day. And that's the largest, most heavily watched parade anywhere in the world, with almost a million people on the streets and another 50 million around the country and some number around the world. And we have the One Legacy Donate Life float in that parade for the last 22 years. And each year we get a billion or more media impressions of our float alone and getting the message out. And we have donor families telling their story, recipients expressing their gratitude, living donors talking about how easy it was to give a kidney. And as we say, wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning in the cold in Pasadena, go out and walk 5.5 miles and smile the whole way, and because their health is perfect, even though they donated a kidney, they're doing just great, as is their recipient who's walking alongside them. So those kind of things really get the message out on a personal basis. We also we have professional education people who work in hospitals. We've got like 35 or 40 of those folks who work with every one of the hospitals, because the donation, as much as it's ultimately pretty rare.
Yeah.
We only 1% or 1.5% of us will pass away in a manner in which we could actually be an organ donor. It's that brain dead on a ventilator with viable organs. Ideally, we all live to be 100, and darn it, our organs are all worn out. But helping keep hospital staff trained and educated, we have a large crew of people who are, you know, some come from marketing and sales backgrounds, some come from public policy, some are just really good with people.
Yeah.
Some are educators. You get a whole mix of that. we work to just be in front of people. And I guess the other really big thing we do is we co-founded, along with our three peer organizations in the state, the Donate Life California Registry, which when you go to the DMV, they ask you, do you want to be an organ, eye, and tissue donor? And you check yes, and you get a pink dot on your license. And we founded that, and we actually run that. The state passed a law that we can run it. And I happen to be the president of the Donate Life California Registry. And we will be checking licenses.
Hopefully. Well, I know I have the pink dot. I can't speak for the other two folks in here, but that's amazing. And I think that one of the things you were gesturing to is the human side of organ donation, right? And so I think one of the things that people would be interested in is, how does One Legacy support donor families and its recipients throughout the donation and transplantation process to ensure a compassionate care and long-term support?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that is sort of the unknown or the unexpected part of this, because understandably, most people think of this about transplantation being about the recipient and their lives are being saved. But we actually seldom see a recipient until after they've gotten their transplant, and they might want to come back and be a volunteer with us. We see only donor families. And helping donor families deal with that shock and that loss, and usually it's a shock. It's usually they did not know their loved one was going to have a stroke or an accident or whatever the case may be that resulted in them coming brain dead and being declared dead, but still on a ventilator and still getting their organs perfused with nutrition and oxygen so the organs are viable, and not really even knowing that their loved one has passed. We have to help them see they have passed. They cannot recover. Their heart's only beating because they're on a ventilator. So there's a lot of a very sensitive caring for educating, sure, but also helping them understand their loved one has gone. And sometimes it takes a while, and we give time. We also are people who work with families at this point. They're an interesting group because it is probably the least formalized criteria of what you need is prior experience. You might think we had social workers. You might think we had psychologists. The reality is many of our people do this, may have an AA or may have a BA in something completely strange, but they have an incredible human compassion and empathy and ability to communicate and connect with people, and that's what we look for. And so it's an interesting group of people who do this caring, because they're all about caring and taking care of that family and helping the family deal with this and helping the family see that they can make something good come from this loss. And that is a remarkable moment when that light bulb goes on for a family that, wait a minute, this is the crappiest day of our life, but we can always remember it for the good of the lives saved.
Yeah. And then paying it forward, right? And ideas like gifting. And I think something that you mentioned was that it's about time. And I think, for me, as someone, I'm in my 40s, and I have parents who are older and kind of in the winter of their lives. I think, you know, I see time as a gift now, right? And I think, you know, how precious time is in all its fashions, right? In all its definitions. So that's amazing what you just said and how relatable it is for everyone. It's a common thread in the human existence that we need time with one another to build, to remember, to need, to want, right? So, but another thing you mentioned, Tom, was about the volunteers.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know that you guys have a program called the Ambassador Program.
Right.
Perhaps you can go into that about volunteering and also the Ambassador Program.
Yeah, the Ambassador Program was actually started by the same person who started Donate Life Hollywood. When I got there, we didn't have any of these public programs, and our donation rates were low, not surprisingly. Putting together these programs, we were able to get the message out. An ambassador turned out to be one of the greatest tools of sharing our message, because I can talk to you here all day long, and I'm speaking to you from the head. But you've talked to somebody who's life was saved by a heart transplant, or health was saved by a kidney transplant, or recovered from an accident with a bone graft, or they can see again because of a cornea transplant. They, and those who've given the gift of life through their family members who've authorized donation or recognized their loved one as a registered donor and let that last choice proceed with them giving the gift, share their gratitude for making something good come from it. They end up being our best educators, we want to call it that. So oftentimes when we go to a hospital and we do a hospital training, our staff member will do an introduction, and this is what we're here for, and talking to doctors, nurses, and other caregivers. But the ambassadors will lead the conversation because they have to connect from the heart. Once you've opened up the heart, the mind pretty much follows.
Yeah.
And so our ambassadors are made up of people who have all been touched by donation and transplant. And for those who are donor family members, they're keeping their memory of their loved one alive. It's definitely beneficial for them. Most of them have come through our grief counseling program, which it used to be 1 year, then it was 2 years. Now it's as long as you want to stay. But many of them continue into being ambassadors because they want to help others who've lost somebody find that comfort and that one little bit of light in the midst of their darkness, because it helped them recover and they know they can help others. And boy, there's nothing more powerful than that.
Yeah.
Nothing can come out of my mouth more powerful than that.
I mean, I think it's quite apropos for these folks who have received organs to kind of become ambassadors, right? It's based on experiential knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. And the experiences they went through.
Right.
And so who better to serve one legacy than the folks who have benefited the most and can tell the story, yeah. You know, who can show that through lived experiences, they've have a new lease on life because of one legacy, right? It's so powerful. And so I think, you know, because we're at Cal State Long Beach, I think we have a connection to the ambassador program, where I actually recently read about Simone D. Washington, a CSULB staffer who received a life-saving organ transplant, who then became a One Legacy ambassador. Tom, can you talk about the impact that One Legacy had on this individual's journey, Simone, in receiving the organ transplant, and how she has raised awareness about organ donation through her story and the work she is doing with One Legacy now?
Yeah, Simone came to us after having gotten her transplant elsewhere, where she was living elsewhere. But she said, I want to share. I want to give back to the community. And it's especially, and she knew what she was saying when she came to us, because donation among the African-American community is one of the lower rates of donation in the country. We certainly find newer immigrant families who don't grow up with donation transplant, don't have trust in the medical system, their donation rates are on the lower side. And African-Americans are too, because of the history of abuse of African-Americans by the medical community, the Tuskegee incidents and things like that, and many others like that, which understandably make people leery. But the need for transplant is highest in the African-American community of all, especially for kidneys, and due to diabetes and kidney failure that results from that, and genetic underlying things. So Simone, who got her transplant, wants her community, as well as all communities, but her community to know that, A, African-Americans do get transplants. There's a myth that they don't, and that they that when organs are recovered, they are recovered from people who voluntarily choose to donate altruistically. Nobody's getting paid for this, and they're not going to the highest bidder. They're going down a national list that is organized by who has the greatest need. And there probably just no place better than Southern California to tell that story, because just this last year, 2024, 71% of the transplants in this area went to persons of color, higher than anywhere in the country. And that is partly because that's where the need is. You know, we don't pick where they're going. They're picked based on, but who gets listed in a transplant center and how sick they are. But the Simone's telling the story from her own experience about why a donation makes a difference and why African-Americans or anybody who needs a transplant will get one and can get one, especially if we all choose to donate.
Amazing. And just, you know, just to go further on this, on the topic of volunteer advocates, what volunteer opportunities are available for students at One Legacy events, and how can these individuals and communities get involved to support your foundation's organization, its mission, and its partnerships?
Yeah, the ambassador program is pretty much open to anybody. We want you to have some sort of connection to or clear interest in donation and transplantation to be able to share that. But there is a need to get out into communities, and we have fairly good but still need to grow schools-based programs, and tying in with, especially if you have people who have like just, you know, finishing high school, just finished high school and set up a lot of high schools. We're setting up clubs and programs, and they were sort of getting training from our staff, and as volunteers going out to their school and other schools in the area as an example of where some of that's, that is going on. We get a lot of people who think of going into pre-med and they want to get closer to medicine, but they don't really, you know, have an access to do this. Well, to come in and volunteer, and in any number of areas, public outreach is one, but also there's potential in some of the clinical arenas to be an assist or at a minimum shadow what the work goes on. I will say it's difficult to be a volunteer in a clinical role in organ donation because the training is incredibly long. This is not something people walk in with the natural skills. So we to have formal internship programs are relatively rare, but once in a while they do happen. But the ability to volunteer to assist in these programs, and especially the outreach, the community outreach, we had 3 weeks ago 200 students from the Inland Empire come to One Legacy, take tours of the facility, see what the career opportunities are in medicine in general and healthcare in general, but also in, of course, in our particular space of it, which our facility looks very much like a hospital. We have ICU beds, we have ORs, we have CT scanners, we have cath labs, we have laboratories. Get to see what those different roles and jobs are. And one very large laboratory there, and the laboratory had took all these students through, giving them an example of what the career opportunities are, which is was the teachers were just bowled over with this because it was all one easy, compact place. And we don't have a lot of public running around, which makes it easier to do this. If you're in a hospital, we're in the way. Not so much in our case. There are a lot of opportunities, and I think they're going to be even more as we expand our high school programs and some of our college internships. I would say I've had two or three administrative interns who've come from various health programs, like master's in health programs, things like that. And the administrative side, we have one with us right now. The sky's the limit.
On the topic of facilities, though, which is interesting, I recently read that One Legacy opened a new center in Azusa that serves as the donor recovery facility and lab. Can you tell us a little bit about that place and the new location and the kind of opportunities that have come out of that place?
Yeah. You know, historically, organ donation has been entirely taking place at donor hospitals. Patients are in a hospital, in an ICU, on a ventilator, and that's where if they pass away, that's where it happens. And historically, that's where One Legacy would work with families, work with the doctors, and do the entire area of testing the donor for infectious diseases, testing their organ function, you know, improving their organ function over 2 or 3 or 4 days, allocating the organs to the right patients by the list, and then overseeing the surgical recovery of those. Well, 20, 25 years ago, one of our colleagues built their own recovery center in St. Louis, and I went and visited that about 20 years ago. I said, this is lovely, but it could never work in Southern California because we have traffic, and I don't want to be moving donors in traffic jams. And I really resisted for a long time, but about 7 years ago, we actually opened a small center out in our Redlands facility, and it was remarkably successful. It was remarkably successful in that we actually ended up placing more organs per donor than we did when we recovered them in the hospital. And 2.5 years ago, we opened up a much larger headquarters facility, and of the 740 donors, organ donors that recovered last year, we recovered 300 of them at our facility in Azusa, and they're brought in on our own ambulances, on the ventilator and the monitors, so the care continues like in the ICU. And we've been able to develop a team who's highly expert at the many things you need to do to assess an organ. Echocardiograms, of course, the simple one, cardiac echoes, CT scans, cardiac catheterizations. And these are all non-physicians doing these things, but they're learning on the job and they're doing them. And they are, as I had a transplant surgeon from Mexico visit 2 months ago, and he said, you don't have doctors doing this? I said, no, what we have is we have incredibly skilled people who only do this on donors. And I will tell you, they'll be more expert than any doctor in any hospital, only does it once in a while. And so what we learned is, and we transplant 30% more organs from donors we recover on site than at the out in the field at hospitals. So it's turned out to be very beneficial in our life-saving mission. And for me, who originally came from a career working in hospitals, it is kind of nice to have the people and the work there and present and actually see them again face to face, just on a totally personal level. But I think it's good for our team and our culture, and there's a lot of learning from one another. So it's been a big change. When I started, we were in a 10,000 square foot office, and now we're in a 250,000 square foot center. And fortunately, donation has grown extraordinarily well over the years to get there.
Amazing. I think one of the things that I started thinking about when you just were talking about that, where opportunities are endless, and they are there if you work hard to learn and reach out for them and just participate. And so I think that gives folks opportunities to work with On One Legacy, work with and have skill sets where they thought were limited to, let's say, the folks who go to medical school, the folks who go to get their MAs, their PhDs, right? So how does this open the door for other individuals to volunteer, to work, to participate, right?
Yeah. Some of it's volunteer and a lot of it's work. We had a couple of sessions in prior years. I'm going to have another one coming up soon with some folks from the Biocom California Institute, which are some people in active healthcare careers, but looking for to better understand other areas of biotech and health and opportunities. And these crossing over, cross-fertilization of organizations, we've been discovering talented people who didn't know that we existed and our work existed. And that those types of relationships and the relationships we've had with the Cal State Long Beach programs have, again, brought in people who opened their eyes. I mean, who the heck ever thought when you grew up you were going to run an organ procurement organization? I didn't. Or you're going to even know what they were. I didn't. And most people don't. And it's so the tying in with other organizations, it's just like when we go back and we talk about making our public education work with the writers, producers where they already have an audience, go to a parade where they already have an audience. Well, go to a place where people who have an interest in healthcare careers already are there, so we have an audience. And it turned out to be an incredibly beneficial way to both expand our message and our mission, but also recruit staff.
You just mentioned about collaboration and working with different organizations, I mean, schools, nonprofits and whatnot. Well, actually, on our last episode, we had Vicky Brannock, who works with the Biocom California Institute. She was discussing life sciences and biotech and the future of those sectors. In relation to that, how is biotechnology advancing the field of organ transplantation to address the current organ shortage crisis?
You know, I literally just came here today from a group called the Terasaki Institute Innovation Summit, and it's all about the leading edge of biotechnology, and these are people creating what they call a spherical nucleic acid to be able to get into a cell, to get into a cancer cell and deliver a med that otherwise would be spread far too wide and effectively to kill that cell and nothing else. Or others coming up with these gels and these literally circuits connected to people to sort of measure things from outside their body. It was fascinating and actually understandable. They did a really good job presenting. They're all very good at that. And a couple of my colleagues in the transplant space were there, which was a pleasure to see them. And they were talking about these huge changes that have been taking place in the last 2 to 3 years, and something as simple as how do you package an organ and how do you ship it? Historically, you'd put an organ in a cooler, saline bath in slush and keep it in a cooler, keep it at 4 degrees centigrade, and get it to where it needed to go as quickly as possible. Now they're being put on what they call normothermic machine perfusion, where there's blood and other solutions being pumped through them at their normal body temperature, and finding out that A, they can last longer, and B, they actually will function better because they are kept in a normal state and they're getting oxygen and they're actually doing even more recovery. More organs are being able to be used and successfully transplanted. Well, that's really only taken off in the last 2 years. We actually started our first liver pumping program in July of this year, and now we're pumping 25% of our livers. It's just overnight. So a dramatic change in the biotech. And we've learned that we need highly skilled perfusionists, something we've never needed before. So we're out recruiting those type of people, for instance. There's another procedure called normothermic regional perfusion, otherwise known as ECMO, which is used oftentimes in open heart surgery. And you have another place we desperately need perfusionists even more. It allows you to keep the circulation going while you're recovering the organs and keep them from having what they call ischemic time, where the all the vessels are, can be damaged because they don't get enough oxygen. It's a little techy here, but the point is, with this technology, suddenly, we're again, increasing the number of organs that can be transplanted because they aren't suffering damage during the recovery process. This has only been around in our space for a year, and I would guess by the end of this year we'll be doing it on 50% of cases. It's just overnight change. And then there's the really wild and crazy part where, as of, I think, today, tomorrow, it'll be the third or fourth month that a woman who got a kidney transplanted from a pig, is back home. She's now back home at her house in Alabama, leading a normal life. Xenotransplantation, as you call it, there's an expression that was coined 40 years ago, and it was, xenotransplantation is right around the corner, and it will be for 20 years. Well, it's been 40 years, but now it actually seems to be happening, and this whole new technology is revolutionizing our work. Ideally, someday it puts us out of work. That and bioprinting, 3D bioprinting of organs. I'm on a committee, a group that's actually studying to do this at the Terasaki Institute, to 3D print livers. There's so much going on simultaneously right now. And there will be a period where there will be human transplants, and there will be bioprinted, and there will be xenotransplants, and they'll all three be going. Ideally, someday we're in a place where no one ever dies while waiting for a transplant.
That's fascinating, especially with the xenotransplantation. Is that what it is, mm-hmm. right? Did I say that correctly?
You said it perfectly. Xenotransplantation.
Okay. And especially, I think that relates to the conversation I had with Vicky last week, or the last episode, where we were discussing AI and how things are quickly evolving, right? And one of the things that came up was ethical considerations. And mm-hmm. So I think what I was curious about before you came in was thinking about the ethical considerations in organ donation and how do life sciences address these concerns?
Yeah, I think, you know, two or three sort of bedrock ethical issues in donation and transplant. And the first one is enshrined in federal law that was established in 1984, the National Organ Transplant Act, which says that organ donation will be a donation. It will be a gift. And in fact, all the laws in the country about the actual gift, or they call it the Anatomical Gift Act, follows gift laws. If you're leaving somebody something in your will, it's a gift, and it can't be paid for it. And that was done for a number of reasons. One, it's been very clear around the world in places where people have been paid for organs, it's the poor who become the organ providers, and you can't even call them donors because they're getting paid for it. And the better off don't donate. And frankly, you'll never have enough organs unless everybody donates when they no longer need those organs. And the reality is, in those places where there's still black markets for and paying for organs, those who do give them up suffer terrible health consequences. Or like Iran, where it's actually formally legalized to be paid for donation, it almost 99% of donors come from the Bedouin community of often illiterate, undereducated, rather than the general population. And shifting that burden to the poor, again, it has its own terrible ethical consequences, but it also doesn't result in enough donors. If everybody's going to be eligible to get a transplant, everybody should be willing to make a transplant possible by giving. So that's the number one, that it's altruistic and not paid. The second one is probably that organs be transplanted to the patients of the highest need. Who's got the greatest need? Who can get the greatest benefit out of this? And this has been an ongoing debate and change in policy over the last 50 years. Used to be that transplant center recovered an organ, they would decide who they gave it to no matter what. Then it was, okay, let's pick the person in greatest need in your area, in Southern California. And now we know that organs can travel a good deal of distance and be successfully transplanted without any harm. Well, who's the person greatest need, like in the western region of the United States, who will die without getting this liver, rather than somebody who doesn't need a transplant for months? Making sure that we're getting to the patient in greatest need. And the great thing about that is we've seen a tremendous drop in the mortality rate of people on the list because of that. So the policies are working well. It took a long time to get in place, and still a lot of fighting over it because it affects the volume of one program versus another. And a doctor's charged with taking care of his or her patient. They're not taking charge of taking care of the population, and they should take care of their patient. So the system and the community and the federal government make sure that the ethics prevail in that. And I guess the last thing is, we talked about donor registries. You got the pink dot on your license. I mean, that is, as if based on gift law, that's your last will and testament. That is your legal decision. And it can't be overturned by family or others who just don't want to do it. Standing by that decision of an individual is a huge ethical consideration. And fortunately, 95% of the time, families say, yeah, we want to honor our loved one, our son, our daughter's, our mother, or father's decision. But once in a while, it's a topic of conversation.
Yeah, I'm sure. Sensitive topic, right?
So yeah, it's like, yeah, very.
So I want to circle back to our university, Cal State Long Beach. We have a program, the Biomanufacturing Sciences and Applications Program. It's a collaboration between One Legacy and the university. And so I was wondering, how do you see the program providing students with a hands-on experience in the field of organ donation and transplantation?
I think the opportunities in these programs come from, A, just some baseline education. This is largely unknown even to healthcare professionals, never mind people who are still students of in the area of healthcare. And again, it's a very rare event in healthcare. Far too often their education comes from TV shows, as we mentioned. But so some of the baseline education of this, and education is what the career opportunities are. If you're a student, you should be, and I'm sure you are, mulling over what your career choices and opportunities are. One of the things, for instance, we get a lot of people, especially in our tissue program. You're recovering bone, and you're recovering corneas, you're recovering heart valves, you're recovering whole hearts for the heart valves from patients who can't be organ donors, but they can be tissue donors. And a lot of the people, I saw three of the staff come in the other day, and I'm guessing they are all about 22, and they all have an interest in going down, becoming surgical techs. And there's probably no better way to learn to be a surgical tech than to spend your time in organ recovery, because you'll do hands-on, where you're a surgical tech in a hospital, you're helping a surgeon do this. Here they'll be actually doing the recoveries. They'll learn how to dissect the femur bone to get out and then replace it with a surrogate so the person can have an open casket funeral and make sure the body looks quite presentable for a funeral. And they've already given the gift of bone or the gift of sight. So they'll get to do these things on their own, which they would never get a chance to do in a normal medical startup job in practice. And it makes a good training for the surgical techs. It also is a lot of pre-meds, or people who, I took an anatomy class, I got to work on frogs and maybe a little bit on a cadaver in a lab, but now I get to do this every day for a year or two. Before I go to med school, we are a stepping stone to med school for a lot of people, and it's been very beneficial to them and very beneficial to us. There's certainly a burnout in this work. You're dealing with death and dying, and some people doesn't burn them out at all. Yeah. Others say this is great to have done, but for a couple of years and then go on and help the living, and that's wonderful too. And so we're happy to share our training there. So there's a lot of opportunities, and you know, at the end of the day, keep an eye on our jobs board and our website, what's open, because that's where the best opportunities come from. It's one thing to be a volunteer and intern and shadow things, but another to get your hands in the work and caring for donors and families and taking the phone calls from donor families. You learn some remarkable skills dealing with a family who's lost someone, but providing them comfort, a whole other area.
Yeah, and you mentioned how One Legacy and volunteering and working with you folks has elevated students and individuals to certain careers and certain positions. How does One Legacy's partnership with our campus, Cal State Long Beach, enhance the educational and career opportunities for students who are trying to pursue their careers in biotechnology and healthcare?
Yeah, well, I think the main things we've done is we've had the university has brought students through the program here to One Legacy to tour the facility, hear lectures from the heads of our departments and our head of education, Rick, or our head of quality program, Blanca, and others who have shared their own career path development, and they're rather esoteric. Rick, who I mentioned, I think was originally in pharmacy school or chemistry. He was originally in chemistry. I remember the chemistry because he went on to become a master beer brewer and won the Golden Road Amateur Beer Brewing Contest one year. So he's a good chemist. But he's also gone on to be our head of education. And he's talking about, here's the education in this space, and here's what you learn and how you learn it. And for a student, there's no better way to see how do I step in. There's what the academic training you get, but what's the training you get that you need to do the job and do the work in a job? And that's true. You go to a hospital, you're going to be in training for a period of time. You go to a doctor's office, you're going to be in training. Well, we have the same thing, and it's fairly complex. And so they in explaining that, they also are explaining what the jobs are. And yeah, when you apply for one of those jobs, you know what you're applying for. Our Blanca, who oversees our quality, has overseen our quality department, talks about the importance of regulation. Well, healthcare, it's a highly regulated space, and the tissue development, tissue recovery side of our work is regulated by the FDA, the organ side by the Medicare program. We have a huge amount of regulatory responsibilities to ensure that the organs and tissues we provide are safe and efficacious and not going to kill someone. So how do you ensure that? What are your processes to make that happen? Identifying when we have some type of... Well, back in the day before we had our recovery facilities, you'd often do tissue recoveries in hospital morgues or in funeral homes. And we would have contamination rates. We and our colleagues everywhere, contamination rates as high as 20%. And sometimes the bone would have to be thrown away or sometimes it'd be irradiated but not as good. When we built our facility, we learned from hospitals, we learned from laboratories, we had processes to build in air handling and filtering. Our contamination rates have dropped to 0.2% from 20%. Well, we describe that process. How did we learn that? How do we implement this? And how do we make sure we have a facilities team? How does that facilities team make sure that these systems are working? And that's a whole other career path. It's another one of the many jobs when you that are needed as the infrastructure to make a life-saving donation happen.
You know, through this whole conversation, we've been talking about people advancing their careers, people advancing their lives, you know. People getting a second chance, you know. A lot of it is the sense of you're always continuously changing yourself, reimagining life, learning more about what you can be, what you can do. And I just wanted to end with your own career journey, Tom. Your journey from a former history major in college.
I told you that, didn't I?
You did tell me that, and so we bring it back, full circle moment, to becoming the CEO. It's quite fascinating, and I just wanted to end by, if you could just share with us how your background in history influenced your career path and what key experiences or decisions led you to the executive role you hold today.
I probably gave you an abbreviated version. It might be a little longer today, but I hope it's good. So I was a history major, and I was focusing a lot on Asian history, Chinese history in particular, and was studying Chinese language and had an intention to go to an Asian studies school with the long-term intention to go to work for the State Department and do international relations. And but I also was paying my way through school and realized I'd need another year at least just to get my language aptitude where it needed to be to get into grad school, and decided I couldn't afford that. So I ended up going to grad school administration at UC Irvine to get a master's in administration. And still going down this path of, okay, I could find a sideways into international relations. It's not uncommon. But I got offered an internship at the College of Medicine, so I did that, and that was interesting. But when I got out, I applied for and got accepted in what's called the Presidential Management Internship Program out in Washington, D.C., and put you in a mid-level job. And my very first interview was in the State Department, and I was with the guy, and he said, so can you tell me where we are? I said, we're in the State Department, and I was excited. He said, yeah, but where are we? I said, we're in the Budget Office of the State Department. That's the businessy side, right? And he said, yeah, but where is it? And I said, well, we're in, I guess, the basement. And he said, yep, and if you take this job, that's where your career is going to go. That was a kind of, oh my God, okay, well, thank you for your honesty, but why? He said, if you want to work in international relations, you have to go through the Foreign Service, and that takes a whole different path, and you know. I said, thank you very much. The next day, I was in the Department of Health and Human Services, and the interviewer said, tell me what you see out the window. I said, what is this, question 101? I said, I see the U.S. Capitol. He said, right. And he said, we're the department that's closest to the Capitol. We have the largest budget of any department in the country, and frankly, any country in the world except the Soviet Union and the United States at the time. And and you're 50 feet from the secretary, and you can make a difference and save lives. so where do you go to work? So I went to the Department of Health and Human Services and went down the healthcare route. A few years later, I ended up working in hospitals here back in California, in mid-level positions, went on to be the CEO of a hospital. The hospital happened to be in an area that, in the San Gabriel Valley, that it, during my tenure there, had a whole lot of Chinese immigration. So every so often I'd get to trot out my limited Chinese, like I could order food or say thank you and things like this. But that was very helpful in my working community. And then I got the opportunity to come to One Legacy, and I contacted some of my community contacts from the Tzu Chi Buddhist community, a Chinese group out of Taiwan, and said, come help me understand the challenges with donation in the Chinese community. And they said, well, would you like us to start a donor registry for you, which floored me. Well, we formed a relationship, and they helped us with families and they also said, but they were trying to start a kidney transplant program and an OPO in Taiwan, and would I go there and help them do that? Well, I ended up making 4 trips there. They started their OPO. They started their program. There's now, they came up with a new model for a nationwide OPO program, which models the U.S. model, which we'd shared with them. And subsequently, I've done similar consulting in Kunming, China, in Shanghai, in Seoul, in Tokyo, in Australia, in Germany, in France, all over the world. And one day I sat back and said, well, damn, I got to do exactly what I wanted to do, but kind of got detoured, 25, 30, 40 years earlier by the guy in the basement of the State Department. But I got to do exactly what I wanted to do, and it was a reminder that if you have a passion in your career, and it's a real passion, it will stay there if it's real. And let the career opportunities, follow them where they may. Sometimes you just got to pay your bills. But if the passions are real, you will find a way to live them out. And you'll get the best of all worlds. I certainly have. And I actually thank the guy in the State Department for telling me that that would have been the basements where that career would have ended up, because I got to do exactly what I wanted and a whole career in healthcare. And the great gratitude of knowing that being able to help families make something good from their loss and others go on to very healthy, rich lives.
That's amazing. I think, 3 things that came up with what you just said and how you ended our show. We all go through different paths in our lives. And something that we've talked about in previous episodes, that there's always room to do something else. It's not starting again, but just extending who you are to a different plane, right? To reimagine your lot in life, to think about different opportunities, right? Lifelong learning.
Yeah.
Just recenter and refocus. Something I mentioned with Noel Hasagaba from the Port of Long Beach, that there's always time. There's always time. Going back to the idea of time, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And the third thing, I'm so happy you mentioned it, because my coworker here, Angelo, and I, both alumnus at UC Irvine, so zot, zot.
Zot, zot.
Hey, shout out to UC Irvine.
Almost do the thing. Yeah, something like that. Here we go. I've lost my zot skills.
It always stays with you. But really, thank you so much, Tom, for joining us and giving us insight to One Legacy and, the really giving it a very human face and a compassionate face to organ donation and what that means to families and those who donate and those who receive, and that it's just a humanistic quality that we give one another, right? So thank you so much.
Well, I thank you very much for the chance to share these with this audience today, and certainly appreciate the chance to be with the students from the programs here at UC Cal State Long Beach. They've actually been inspiring to my team. The couple of folks I talked to said, we jump at the chance to come and have these conversations with them, and I see a lot of potential there.
Amazing. Thank you for tuning in to Pacing Your Future. We hope today's installment has inspired you and provided valuable insights into the dynamic world of industry and innovation. Stay tuned with us for more stories, opportunities, and expert advice to help you navigate and shape your future. Until next time, keep pacing your future with confidence and curiosity.